Hey, Scott Spears back with you here on this Thursday, June the 13th, 2019, 15 minutes past the hour. And this hour, we are going to have a very unique conversation about a very interesting place here in Ohio. We're going to talk about Western Governors University, Ohio's newest university. Now, there are a lot of things about this university that make it very unique, and it's right here in our own state. And to talk about this for the next 45 minutes, we're so glad to be joined by the Chancellor of Western Governors University, Rebecca Watts. Rebecca, how are you?
Doing very well, Scott. Thanks for the opportunity to visit with you today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you on and learn about a great organization like this in Ohio. How did you come to Western Governors University?
I came to Western Governors University. I actually returned to Ohio to serve in this role, but I was very familiar with Western Governors because I served for 4 years at the Ohio Department of Higher Education and had learned a great deal about Western Governors and about its unique approach to help adults who are looking to move forward in their career pathways and to do it in a way that meets not just in-demand career competencies, skills, and knowledge, but also meets adults where they are. And so many of us, myself included, when we went to college, we were working full-time and paying bills and trying to keep the household afloat while we were also trying to move ahead.
Mm. Now, tell us how this all came about.
So Western Governors University is a national university. It was actually founded in 1997 by a group of governors who really wanted to create their own university that really addressed workforce in-demand career needs. And for many of them, they felt like the universities and the colleges in their respective states were doing a great job, but were not aligned enough with what employers were looking for and really staying current with what employers were looking for. So they created a university that is focused. There are only four colleges: information technology, business, health professions, and teachers. And they have industry representatives. So for the teachers' college, they have educators. For health professions, they have people that work for health systems, healthcare providers, and business and information technology the same, that they stay, and now that we're in Ohio, we stay very closely connected to make sure that the competencies that are embedded in our programs are the competencies that employers are looking for. So as the university continued to evolve and grow, it developed the concept of state affiliates. So the first state affiliate was in Indiana, and there are now eight, Ohio being the newest. So there are state affiliates for WGU in Indiana, Tennessee, North Carolina, Texas, Nevada, Washington, and Ohio. Oh, and Missouri. I skipped Missouri. I apologize. So there are eight state affiliates for WGU. And so what that means is we now have a physical presence in the state where we are on the ground meeting with employers, meeting with prospective students, meeting with current students every week to make sure that what we are doing is meeting the needs of all of the above. And so, and we also have about 145 faculty that work in the state serving students, and they work remotely, so they work out of their homes.
So how do, so the faculty is not a typical faculty of another college?
That's correct. We have three unique faculty roles. The first faculty role is a graduate-prepared person in the discipline. So I'll use the example of business. This person would have minimally a master's degree in business, and they serve as a program mentor student-facing. So they have a set of students that they support throughout that student's journey through the program. Because our programs are self-paced, every student is at a different point in their program completion. So that program mentor meets with, virtually, through FaceTime, video chat, phone, text, email, you name it. They connect in multiple ways on a weekly basis. And that program mentor is a content expert in that field, but they also are specially trained to be supportive of the continuous forward movement of the student. So they can say to the student, Sue, I see that you haven't been moving forward in your progress in the course for principles of accounting. What can I do to help you? And so sometimes they'll talk about content. Sometimes what that program mentor will do is make an appointment for Sue, the student, to meet one-on-one with the course instructor. That's the second faculty role that I'll talk about. The course instructors, of course, also graduate prepared in the content, deliver the content for individual courses, and our courses are comprised of bundles of competencies. So that, if, let's say, Sue, our student, has really kind of hit a snag in a principles of accounting course, a concept that she's having a hard time getting through. We get her one-on-one time with that course instructor. So think of it as really a one-on-one office hours and tutoring session all at the same time. So the course instructor engages with the student. Our third principal faculty role is the course evaluator. And so the course instructor and the program mentor are not the people that grade the student and whether the student has achieved the competency required to move on from that course. That's a third faculty role, again, graduate prepared in the discipline, but they are evaluating that student's demonstration of competency. Sometimes, depends on the course, sometimes that's a written assessment, sometimes that's a presentation, sometimes it's a paper, sometimes it's a speech. So the evaluators are, of course, discipline-specific and content-specific, and they are then evaluating that student on whether or not that student has demonstrated competency, exceeded competency, or still needs to do some more work before they move on to the next course. Our courses are sequential, not simultaneous, so students move through their work one course at a time, building that foundation of knowledge that they need to work through till they get to that the end of that program.
Could this type of university have happened before internet became prevalent and everybody had it?
It would have been exceptionally difficult. So the technology is very supportive of the model. It is a model that ostensibly, if the internet were not there, it is a model that ostensibly could be done, but it would have to be done through other technology. And so Your question is very valid and pointed in that the time was right to move to this kind of a model because there was the foundation of the technologies needed to support the model by the early 2000s. So you point out a very important aspect of what we do.
It's very interesting. We've learned that last year, Ohio education officials approved WGU programs in health and nursing, business, teaching, and information technology, making it the eighth state to partner with WGU. How long a process was that, and what goes into approving that?
It is a lengthy process that is led by the Ohio Department of Higher Education, and it is a rigorous process whereby an institution first applies to be authorized in the state and submits an initial letter of interest. And then that letter is received, and the Department of Higher Ed then begins to gather the information from the institution about its program, its curriculum, its faculty, how the program works, how students are supported, what the fiscal models are for the university, and they begin a very rigorous deep dive of all of that information. This can take months to over a year. The next step is for the Department of Higher Ed officials to actually do a site visit to the administrative main central office of the university. For many universities, that would be their kind of flagship campus. For WGU, that would be the leadership offices in Salt Lake City, Utah. So that happened. The Ohio Department of Higher Ed went out and did a site visit there, met with the provost, met with the president, met with the deans of each of the colleges, met with faculty, looked at faculty records, looked at student experiences, looked at the curriculum, looked on site, looked to assure that what they had been given in writing was actually the experience that students have and the support that students get at the university. So again, think about that. Then that's another big chunk of time to schedule that visit, to go be on site and do that visit. Then the Department of Higher Ed folks come back to the state and they evaluate everything that they've read, that they've learned, that they've seen, that they've witnessed. And then they look at that against the requirements to be an authorized institution in Ohio. And they identify how that matches up. So again, this takes another series of months. So the institutional authorization for WGU in Ohio was granted in January of 2018, but the work began nearly 2 years before that.
It's very interesting because it certainly does shake up a lot of the long-standing traditions at universities. Is there feedback from other universities in Ohio and other states where this exists?
You know, other universities are not sitting still. Other universities are moving forward and looking at their delivery models as well. So there is feedback, there is dialogue, there is open discussion. I will use the example of the Ohio community colleges, the 23 community colleges in the state of Ohio. They are strong partners of WGU Ohio. They have talked with us about how their graduates might then transition into a program at WGU. And when they think about that, I think they especially had deep interest in what the working adult would be able to do in terms of, after completing an associate degree, would they be able to move on to a baccalaureate degree? They also looked at our model closely and determined that, in fact, we would be a great partner for a transition for their graduates who chose to continue to matriculate to a baccalaureate degree in an online competency-based model. I want to lift up especially Sinclair Community College because I want to make note that Sinclair Community College has developed some competency-based programs of their own. So moving toward this model while continuing to deliver their traditional models. So it is happening across the state. It is happening across the nation that people are understanding the need for higher education to continue to evolve. It's evolved over the centuries, and it is continuing to evolve, I would argue, at an even quicker pace in the 21st century than it did in prior centuries.
Now, if somebody wanted to become a teacher, what would be the process with an associate? So you have to have an associate degree first, right?
You do not have to have an associate degree.
Okay.
You do not. Many people do, though, because they have availed themselves of their community colleges in their local communities. When we think about Marion Tech, when we think about COTC, Columbus State, a lot of folks have availed themselves of that opportunity. And so many of our students do come to us with an associate degree, but it is not required.
So if you do not have any college and you want to be a teacher, what is the process like?
So you would apply for admission. We are not open admission. And we understand that the uniqueness of our model means that when we determine if a person is ready for success at our institution, that evaluation has to really kind of go beyond kind of technical content readiness. So we always think about the ACT and the SAT. Those are the traditional application requirements when we look at folks that are applying to colleges and universities. But we go beyond that because we understand that to be successful in our model, there need to be some real key characteristics. For example, in the example you used, that person would meet this requirement. But we do not have undeclared majors. So you can't come to us and say, well, I'm just going to do my general education because I don't know what I want to major in. I don't know what I want my career pathway to be. So the first requirement that we have is this person committed to that pathway? So let's take your example. Somebody has decided they want to be a teacher. And I'm going to flesh out your example just a little bit. That person knows they want to be a teacher because they have been working as a teacher aide in their local school district. And they had gone to a community college and gotten the required associate degree to be a teacher aide, but then they really feel like it's time to take that next step. So they apply to WGU, and they apply to the teacher's college, and they declare which license in Ohio they would like to have. Do they want to be a special education teacher? Do they want to teach grades K through 5? Do they want to teach in the high school and teach a content area? So they have to declare even more discreetly what their goal is. Then they go through the admissions process. They are found to be a person who is believed to be successful. We believe that they have all of the passion and the commitment and the preparation needed to be successful in their program. They then begin their program. We begin students at the first of any month because, again, it's self-paced, so the student moves through the program as they can demonstrate their competency. So you go through the admissions process, and then let's say this student chooses to enroll August 1st, to begin the program August 1st. They start one course at a time, accessing their material, and they move through their learning. They move through their competencies. They take their courses, and then they complete that first course. They're successful. They move on to the next. The whole time engaging with that program mentor and that course instructor and, of course, the evaluator. They move through their program, and I have seen people describe their process of moving through as many as 45 competency units in a six-month term. Now, keep in mind, a competency unit is not a course. A course is a bundle of competency units. So they move through. They finish that six-month period. We don't take summer breaks. We don't take holiday breaks. We don't take breaks. So that student then at the end of that first six-month term then establishes their goals for that next six-month term, and they move through and complete that next section of courses. If they choose to take a break in between, they can, but it is discouraged. I will tell you that a lot of people choose to take a break in the month of December if that comes at the end of a six-month term, just because life is busy for them, often in December because of holidays. So they move through their six-month terms, completing their courses at the speed that they can, and then it comes to the point of a teacher's preparation where then they have to do field placements. And we are working with dozens of school districts around Ohio in our teacher's college, and they will go out and they will do observations of a teacher in a classroom. This is while they are nearing the end of their program. Then the real capstone on their program is that they do demonstration teaching, which is student teaching. So they get to the end of that program. They are now in an Ohio school district doing their student teaching, which is very familiar concept to all of us who have been through schools and had student teachers and engaged with them. They finish that capstone. Then they take the required licensure exam. Actually, they have to do that before demonstration teaching. Take the required licensure exam. They finish that demonstration teaching. That classroom teacher and the field supervisor evaluate how well they did with that. If they did well, then they report that the student successfully completed that requirement. And then WGU recommends them to the Ohio Department of Education for the educator license for which they were prepared.
What is the success rate at this point in Ohio for people who want to be a teacher, want to be in business, want to be in nursing? I remember years ago when you would go to colleges, you know, the orientation was look to your left, look to your right. One of these people will not be here at the end of this.
Yeah, that is a terrible thing that I know historically was done. And in fact, I recently saw a documentary wherein a university president said, would we accept that if when we went in to be admitted to the hospital, they said that to us as we went into surgery? Look to your left, look to your right. I don't think we would accept that, so it's not acceptable for universities either. So our persistence rate is very high. Our degree completion rate for our undergraduate degrees is over 50%, which I know if you haven't worked in higher ed, what's the point of comparison there? That ranks really well when we look at peer institutions around the country. That's a six-year graduation rate. I will tell you that we are continuing to work to improve that graduation rate, that persistence rate. And then the big question then is, once you graduate, was it a value? Was it something that you should have done? Did it improve your career status? And we know that within just 2 years of graduating, our students report to us an increase in salary on average of $21,000 a year.
It's also interesting to me that the average age of a WGU Ohio student is 37 years old. Now, I would think that a lot of younger people, maybe out of high school, would be interested in this. Why do you think the number is 37?
think the number is 37 because, well, let me start with this statistic. More than 70% of our students in Ohio do come to us with some college but no degree. That every individual has a different story. But one thing that tells us is they went a traditional route, or they attempted post-secondary education in some form after high school and were not successful in that they didn't complete a degree. We'll look at that as a measure of success. So we know that they had a desire for post-secondary education. They had a motivation for it. But however their life circumstances were at that time, it didn't work for them. The desire is not gone. The motivation is not gone. But the how has become more difficult because if you attempt post-secondary education and you don't complete the degree, then you get afterlife. You get yourself in a job and you begin a family and you're a member of your community and your church and you're a busy, busy person doing great things. But there's always that piece that you know that you could elevate your long-term earning potential and the holistic wellness of your family and really of your whole community if you could advance your skills and knowledge. So I think a lot of people find themselves in that circumstance where they tried it, it didn't work, they got afterlife, and now they see a pathway that they could really make a step forward. I think the other group of people that find themselves in that average age range, it's pretty normal distribution, actually. Some of our students are in their 60s, and we do have students that are 18. But that big part of the bell curve in the middle, I think folks are also looking for advanced degrees. So we have bachelor's degrees and we have master's degrees. And when you think about you get into a career with your bachelor's degree and you advance through expertise, through years of experience, years of loyalty to your employer, and you see that next opportunity out there, but it requires a graduate level degree. So I think that's another motivation for folks kind of in that age group. That's a kind of a transition age in your career. You have gotten past the early years of your career and now you're ready to advance. So I think it's for both undergraduates and graduate students that we see different motivations.
A big issue for a lot of people, and we hear about it all the time, is student debt and cost of college and what all goes into that. What is the case at Western Governors University?
We have an initiative at Western Governors University to address this very thing. And I guess the first thing I need to talk about is that our tuition for 2 6-month academic terms, so a full calendar year, for undergraduate degrees is $7,000, and for graduate degrees is about $7,500, which is exceptionally affordable compared to some other institutions. However, it is the case that most of us don't have those funds sitting around to be able to support post-secondary education. So some of our students are supported by their employers, providing a tuition reimbursement or pre-imbursement benefit, but it is the case that some of our students do borrow. We started in 2013 the Responsible Borrowing Initiative. We affectionately call it RBI. In baseball season, that's always fun to talk about. So through the RBI, we require any student who declares an intent to apply for a loan, we require them to have a counseling session with a financial advisor. And the focus of that counseling session is do not borrow more than you need. And when we look at mounting student debt in this country, and it is a big concern nationally, one of the things that has led to that is that students see the amount that they need, and then they see the amount that the lenders will actually loan them, and there's a big difference there. It is tempting to opt for that higher amount. Our counseling focuses on do not opt for that higher amount. Please only borrow what you need to constrain your debt on the back end. And so since 2013, our average borrowing per year has decreased by more than 40%. So, and we're having success with those counseling sessions. At this point, 65% of borrowers who are WGU students accept the recommendation to borrow less. And another 10% decline loans altogether. So we're having an impact on 75% of the students who declare an intent to borrow. And none of us like to borrow, but sometimes circumstances require that we do. Our goal here is to keep that risk as low as possible so that the student is paying back the smallest amount possible.
When we talk about traditional colleges and classrooms and having to be there at a certain time and having to go in and stay for a certain amount of time, why does that not work for so many people? Why has that become a hindrance to graduating?
It doesn't work because it's not an appropriate measure of outcomes. When you look at what someone gains through education, it should not be a measure of time served. It should be a measure of what they've learned and what they've, the skills and knowledge that they've gained. And that's the difference in a competencies-based approach. And when we see people who are accelerating through a program, I mean, let's even think about this in K-12, are really gifted students. They grasp some concepts. So some students are very gifted in mathematics, some in English. They grasp those concepts very quickly. But when we move through in a cohort model with everybody in the same room and having to move through the learning at the same pace as everyone else, for some students, that is way too slow, and it is a waste of their time when, in fact, they could be moving on to the next concept, to the next competency, to the next piece of knowledge. For other students, it may be too fast for some subjects, just right for others, and too slow for others. So the lockstep, we all move through our learning at the same pace on all subjects, is really harmful to the individual, each individual in that classroom, because the likelihood that each of us are going to learn at the same rate and the same pace and the same depth of knowledge is very low. It is very unlikely that that's the case. So it's really important for us to be able to address, meet students where they are, and let them accelerate as best meets their needs.
Is it ever hard to determine competency? Because to me, that would seem like kind of an outlier. What people know, how fast they're accelerating, how fast they could go. I think that would be a hard thing to determine. Is it ever hard to determine?
Our competencies assessments are developed with input from business and industry. So that's really important input to us. And of course, from traditional academics, what do students in a business program need to know and be able to do? In developing the competencies assessments, the things that are quantitatively measured, I would argue it's more clear-cut what that assessment is. So let's say it's computer science, and the competency is writing code. It's pretty clear what is, if you're able to write code to achieve a particular outcome. In our general education courses, and this is true for all universities, there is some subjectivity in it. So I myself have taught public speaking 101 in colleges and universities across several states. To the degree that you can, you develop a rubric, and is the student providing data and research to back up what they're doing? Is the student making eye contact with the audience? Is the student making clear definitions and descriptions of what they're trying to do? So you quantify that as much as you can, but I will say that for some of our subjects, it is a bit, it takes a little bit more effort to make sure that those competencies are quantifiable. But remember, we have the help of employers, and so they're saying, this is what I need people to be able to do when they come to work at my bank or my insurance company or my hospital. And so that really informs us what is competency and how is it best demonstrated.
There is an issue in Ohio right now about the workforce, working adults, not having college credentials. Now, is this being addressed?
Yes. So right now, the state has a goal of post-secondary attainment of 65% of adults age 25 to 64 holding some post-secondary credential. The goal doesn't say certificate, associate degree, bachelor's degree, master's degree, doctorate. It does not define how many should have X, Y, or Z. But it is, that goal is informed by economic forecasters. Specifically, it's first emerged from Georgetown University, the economic experts there, Tony Carnevale. We are not close. We are down in the 40% range of the adults in the state, age 25 to 64, that need some post-secondary credential to be eligible for the in-demand careers of the future. And the future is not far away. When the study was done, it was basically talking about 2025. So, yes, it's being addressed. Are we on pace to reach the goal? I would argue that we need to step it up. And we are seeing some policy initiatives at the state level start to emerge that would really help with that. We are also seeing individuals understanding that to get to that next step or to be in a truly in-demand career that is viable for the long-term future, they are going to need to grow their skills and knowledge. So our numbers are increasing. Our percentage of adults with a post-secondary credential is increasing every year. Is it quick enough to reach the goal by 2025? We have some work to do.
How do you think we got so far behind the goal in Ohio?
Well, the good news is we are not the only state so far behind the goal. I think one of the reasons that we got so far behind the goal is that the target was moving. The targeted need for post-secondary credentials was moving because business and industry is changing in front of our very eyes. When we look at what it meant for a person to go into the historic legacy family business. So let's say they went to work at an automotive plant in Ohio. That was a great opportunity straight out of high school. What we're hearing from manufacturers now, though, is that they need folks to have a certificate in advanced manufacturing, to have skills and knowledge in logistics, to have skills and knowledge in coding, because working in a manufacturing center is different now than it was 20 years ago. I don't think it's that people weren't paying attention. I think it's people were working hard and moving into viable careers to support their families. The challenge was that those careers were changing in front of our very eyes, and that pace of change has accelerated, and I think that's where the gap came from.
You know, it's interesting to me because about 15 years ago, I remember there was an overwhelming amount of people who wanted to be teachers in Ohio and were getting their degrees, and there weren't enough jobs to go around. And now I was just looking at jobs the other day that people are trying to fill, and for the first time in a long time in the one ads, I'm seeing jobs for teachers, and certainly nursing is always in there. Why is there such a lack in getting those type of jobs filled here? And is that commonplace around the country?
It varies by state, but I would say more states are in the situation of Ohio than not. And I don't know if you've looked at the detail on the want ads that you're seeing related to teachers, but this is the case in Ohio, and it is the case across the country that there are key shortage areas for teachers. Special education being one of them. High school STEM fields, so science, technology, engineering, mathematics. So math and science teachers, physics, chemistry, biological sciences, earth sciences. Those are key need areas in Ohio schools and really around the country. There is not so much a shortage of elementary teachers in Ohio or really around the country for the most part. So what we are seeing are targeted areas of really high demand and low supply. And it likely got that way because the specialization needed to support all student learning has become a little bit more discreet, more detailed as education has evolved. But the other piece of this is there have been discouragement for families sometimes, and even career advisors sometimes will advise people away from teaching. And they do that because they say, you're the best and brightest. You need to be doing X, Y, or Z. My question is, don't we want our best and brightest teaching? So I think we've had kind of an amalgam of challenges whereby really people who would be great educators have been discouraged from going into the profession. And then we have a need for specialization that sometimes, let's take the high school STEM, for example. Sometimes people say, oh, I'm terrible at math. I'm no good at science, but I want to be a teacher. But I'm not going to teach high school math and science. I want to teach at the elementary level so I don't have to do the more advanced levels of math and science. Well, we don't know that that person wouldn't be the greatest high school math or science teacher in the world, but maybe they just had a bad experience in sixth grade with math and science and struggled that year and then kind of washed their hands of it. So I think it's a lot of factors, but it is the case that we need to lift up education as an important profession that moves society forward, that requires great talent, great passion, great commitment, and a willingness to really be a person who can lift up the learning of a wide variety of student needs in their classroom. That is an amazing calling, and I think we need to do all, society needs to do a better job of really making a clarion call for you would be an absolute wonderful teacher and shape generations for years to come.
If through these programs you can be a teacher, you can be in business, you can be in nursing, you can be in health, is there just no stopping this as technology advances? And is there going to be that traditional level left in 20, 30 years at traditional colleges?
I absolutely believe traditional colleges and universities are here to stay. I say this to anyone who talks to me about WGU and the model and how they interface with it. Our model is a perfect model for a set of people that are highly motivated, that understand accessing the information at their own pace, that are really driven to build their competencies, that do well with that program mentor really giving them one-on-one guidance all the time. However, I also say if you are a person that is a young person that is really looking for that residential university experience where you go to the basketball games and the football games and the concerts and you live in a dorm, and that's what part of what you're looking for in your higher ed experience, we can't offer that. WGU can't offer that. And so I think people need to decide which model is best for them, where they are in their lives, and what will move them that next step forward. And so, yes, I absolutely believe traditional colleges and universities are here to stay. They serve a huge need in society, and they will continue to serve that need. I also believe that we will continue to innovate in post-secondary education, and you will see more and more models at WGU expanding our services, but also through other universities starting to look at how and through what means and through what measures they educate their students, all while meeting the requirements of the accreditors and the government, the state government and the federal government. So within the constraint of requirements, and as those requirements evolve over time, as they see what works really well, I think innovation will continue, but I think tradition will continue as well.
How far do you think the expansion of WGU will go?
Our enrollment continues to grow. The number of graduates that we have continue to grow. Yet there is still so much unmet need that I believe WGU will continue to grow. I believe our traditional universities and colleges will continue to grow. I believe other innovative universities will continue to grow because the need is yet unmet. And I'll give you this statistic just for Ohio. In Ohio, there are 975,000 Ohioans with some college and no degree. Some portion of them would be better served in their career pathway if they could get to a degree or minimally an industry credential to move them along. When you think about almost a million Ohioans and you think about the capacity that we have at our colleges and universities throughout the state, great, great colleges and universities throughout the state, and the addition of WGU to that, we all could continue to connect with individuals and enroll them, and we still would have unmet need in the state.
How do most people find out about it? Is it hard getting the word out?
It's not that hard getting the word out. We have three strategic partnerships managers in Ohio, and we have one in the east, one in the central, and one in the west portion of the state. And they are out meeting with employers and community colleges and employees at the employers and students at the community colleges, as well as faculty, all the time. So they are out telling the WGU story. Our alumni are out there telling the WGU story all the time, telling the experience that they had, telling it to their peers at work, telling it to their families, telling their friends and neighbors. And when you think about the most credible message, it is from someone who has experienced it, whatever it is, whatever we're talking about, in this instance, post-secondary education. And then we also do have, of course, a web presence. We have a website with detailed information. And then we do the traditional information sharing that most universities do, whether it's newspaper ads, radio ads, TV ads, billboards, those sorts of things. And for us, it's really the partnerships that we have with employers, because when we partner with an employer to provide opportunities for their employees, they, of course, are sharing that information out with their staff as well.
You know, clearly for the traditional colleges, the students that come to WGU come for a certain setup, a certain way of doing things. Are there any drawbacks to WGU for the students who come there?
I would consider it a drawback, but I would consider it an expectation and an important consideration for students before they begin any education program. But I would say especially a WGU program, and that is that the student has to understand the rigor of the program, the challenge of the learning, and the commitment to time management and discipline. One of the many questions that students are asked when they apply to WGU is, can you commit 20 hours a week to your studies? And it's quantified in that way for them. And when we think about a 7-day week, and it doesn't have to be divided up 3 hours a night, but on the weekend, how many hours can you commit? On a weeknight, how many hours can you commit? And that is an important question, and when the student is asked the question, it is to be able to set them up for success and establish that expectation early on for them. What really will be required for success is time management, discipline, and commitment.
If somebody's out there listening right now and wanted more information, or what do they need to approach WGU to get involved?
I would recommend that they would go to our website, which is wgu.edu/Ohio, wgu.edu/Ohio. And there is a request info button, and there's an apply now button. There's also a chat button. I would recommend starting either with the request info button or the chat button to learn more, to learn if WGU's model actually fits with what they are looking to do in career advancement, in developing their skills and knowledge. And just start that exploration and ask question after question after question. This is a big decision that people make, and they should go into it having as much information as possible.
Absolutely. Again, that's wgu.edu/Ohio. Do a lot of people get turned down? Is there a turndown rate when people apply?
We do have some students that are not determined to be ready for success, and so they are not admitted. But we have opportunities in place for them that can help them strengthen that preparedness, depending on what was determined to be that specific area of unpreparedness for them, whether it's shoring up their skills and knowledge in mathematics and English, whether it's looking at a kind of discernment, making sure that you know you're on the right career pathway. So we do not admit 100%, but we admit more than 90% of people who apply.
Hmm. Very interesting. We've been chatting with Rebecca Watts, the Chancellor of Western Governors University, Ohio's newest university, and it's here and maybe the wave of the future to come. Thank you so much, Rebecca. It's been very fascinating today.
I so appreciate the opportunity, Scott. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
How about that? The way things all shake out in the end. I'm done for today, but more programming right around the corner. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
The first thing that occurred to me to do was to play Hello to the Chief. And George Wilson, quite a little bit, just started dancing.
To legendary talk show host Phil Donahue.
Man.